You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 12th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, folks. I have begun my long-awaited vacation. Over the weekend, Myla turned, what was it, nine? She's old, folks. And theoretically, I have recovered from the sleepover party that we've had with the four other nine-year-old girls. I am probably hungover right now. The amount of alcohol that took to sustain myself. Having five kids under one roof. I don't understand how people do that. It's crazy. My understanding is there are some families where they actually have more than two children. Be that as it may, still got fresh content for you today. My interview with Marion Nestle, author of, well, many books. Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, Taking Sides, Clashing Views on Controversial Issues in Food and Nutrition, a blogger at foodpolitics.com. Tomorrow on the program, Matt and Mike have recorded another fresh program for you. Then on Thursday, we will have a deep, deep archive show. Freebies and members will hear, I think it was Janine and I, interviewed Amy Goodman and Anthony Arnove back in June of 2004. Amy had a new book out at that time, 10 years ago. And then members will listen to Janine and I talk to the director, John Sayles, also back, well, almost to the day, 10 years ago, in August of 2004. On Friday, RJ Eskow, Shenna Bellows. Members will hear Janine and I interview with George Carlin. And then next week, John Nichols, and a deep archive of Rick Perlstein, and also Saddam Hussein, we interviewed. It wasn't actually Saddam Hussein. Longtime listeners know who it is. And then members will hear from Mark Danner and Lewis Lapham. So we'll be back live in a week from tomorrow, but you'll have mostly fresh content or content you haven't heard in a long time. All right, here's that interview with Marion Nestle. We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Marion Nestle. She is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at and Professor of Sociology at New York University. Welcome to the program, Marion. I should also say, obviously, author or I guess the editor of Eat, Drink, Vote and the author of Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, many other books as well, and the proprietor of foodpolitics.com. Welcome to the program, Marion.
Oh, glad to be here. And just for the record, it's Nestle, not Nestle.
Oh, Nestle.
No relation to the multinational food company, and I'm author of both books.
Okay, well, that's good to note, and I appreciate your coming on. So let's start first with the dual problem that we have in this country of food insecurity on one hand and obesity on the other. Give us a sense. How it is that our policies in this country regarding food have led to this this paradox?
Well, I think, first of all, this is a worldwide problem, not just a problem in the United States. But both problems trace their roots back to income inequality. If we had better income equality in this country, we would have much less problem with undernutrition and not having enough food, or what we're now calling food insecurity. And because the rates of obesity are much higher in the poor in this country, we would have less problem with that as well. So this is a problem of income inequality.
And so let's talk about how, I think it's clear, I would imagine it's somewhat intuitive to understand food insecurity as a function of income inequality. How does that play in with obesity?
Well, it has to do with the quality of the food that you buy. If you're hungry and don't have enough food, you're going to look for foods that have the highest number of calories for the lowest possible cost. And that's junk foods in this country. And that's what your options are going to be. And, of course, the makers of junk foods advertise specifically to low-income populations. They make sure that their products are widely available in low-income areas. They have stores that get set up specially to sell to poor people. Walmart's is a prime example, but there are plenty of others. And the whole system is set up to try to push lower quality, higher calorie foods on poor people.
Well, let's talk about
who have no other options.
So, when you say the whole system is set up that way, let's talk about our food system in this country. Let's start with sort of the relationship between things like fruits and vegetables versus commodity crops. What are commodity crops, and how does our system promote that?
Yeah, well, that's probably the easiest example. Commodity crops are crops like corn, soybeans, sugar beets would be another one, where the government either subsidizes or controls the price in some way of those commodities through farm bill provisions. And those provisions, whatever they are, end up encouraging the producers of those foods to produce as much as they possibly can. And because of supply and demand, then the cost of those commodities is lower for just about everybody. Those kinds of price supports, tariffs, quotas, none of those things apply to fruits and vegetables. Fruits and vegetables historically have been considered to be specialty crops by the Department of Agriculture, and they receive no government subsidies, no government special pricing concerns, except in small pilot projects.
So, I mean, how long has this system been in place? I mean, is always the case in this country that we were involved in promoting essentially, I guess, I mean, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but for lack of a better term, like bad food?
Well, the system started during the Great Depression of the 1930s, when there was really a terrible problem that farmers were producing food, but nobody could afford to buy them. So farmers had to destroy their crops because they had no outlet for them, while there were people who were on the streets begging for food. Large numbers of people in those days, not just the way we have it now. So that's how the system got started. And once the system got started, it got entrenched. And then politics took over and kept the subsidy system the way it is now, so that it's almost immutable. Very, very difficult to make any changes in it at this point because it's been entrenched for so long. And the political system is set up so that the very large agricultural producers have a great deal of clout with Congress because they help subsidize congressional campaigns and so forth. So it's been very, very difficult to change that. There were a lot of attempts to try to put into the most recent farm bill subsidies for fruits and vegetables and systems that would promote use of fruits and vegetables and connect agricultural policy to public health. But because of the politics of the farm bill, none of that was able to happen, or very little.
I mean, what happened, my understanding, too, is that in the during the Nixon administration, the plan to subsidize corn in particular really really took root. And that was sort of a conscious attempt to essentially lower the price of food, I guess, ostensibly to provide us all with more buying power and more disposable income. Is that accurate?
Well, I'm not sure it was the Nixon administration. I mean, this has been this has been in every administration, really without exception. And the it's very hard to argue about low food cost. Low food costs mean that everybody in the country has adequate to enough food so that they're not starving on the streets. It's just that the way that the system has evolved is to make the cost of junk foods much cheaper relative to the cost of fruits and vegetables. And, you know, if you look at what's happened in price strategies over the last 25 or 30 years, and these figures are collected by the Department of Commerce, the index price of fruits and vegetables has gone up much, much further than the index price of food as a whole, or of foods like sodas in particular, where the index price has gone up much, much more slowly than the index price of fruits and vegetables. They're way at the top of food costs. So when poor people say they can't afford to buy fruits and vegetables, they're not kidding.
I mean, so what do we do about this?
Well, we change policy in some way, and the Department of Agriculture is attempting to do something about it by a number of pilot projects that subsidize the cost of fruits and vegetables at farmers markets, that allow people with food stamps to get twice the value of their food stamp benefits if they buy fruits and vegetables. I mean, there are a lot of these projects floating around throughout the country. They seem to work pretty well. But they're not national policy. If we want to do something to promote healthier foods among poor people, we need to change national policies in ways that provide poor people with more buying power, if not more income.
So to a certain extent, if the goal is to provide people with healthier food, and this is obviously a public health issue because we all in some ways pay for things like diabetes and obesity and all the other diseases that come from the lack of quality food. So on one hand, we have to spend money to basically create this problem because it's so entrenched, and then we also need to spend money to fix this problem. I mean, that seems basically like the dilemma.
Well, that's a pretty good way of putting it. I mean, I think that explains it very well. And so there's been a great effort over the last, say, 10 years to try to link agricultural policy with health policy. But because different agencies of government deal with those things, there's been very, very little coming together over it. And because there are such entrenched political interests in maintaining the system exactly the way it's been and not changing it, it's been very, very difficult to change. So this is a political problem, and it requires a political solution.
Give me a sense of your perspective on labeling. How are we doing in terms of labeling? And as of late, there's been some controversy over the issue of labeling GMOs. I'm curious as to your perspective on labeling in general and specifically in regards to GMOs.
Well, labeling in general is in play right now because the Food and Drug Administration has proposed significant changes to the food label that's been around since the early 1990s and has asked for public comment on it and is currently collecting public comment on it. So when the public comments come in and the FDA has a chance to review them, it will then issue final rules on the new food label. This is a very, very slow process that is set up by Congress to take a very long time and to have a great deal of public interest before regulatory changes are made. But the time period for closure on taking public comments is, I think it's August 1st, is the last day that you can do it. And so if anybody wants to file comments on the proposals, they can go on the FDA website and take a look at how to do that. The GMO labeling is quite different. That's a different story. The FDA decided in 1994 that genetically modified foods did not have to be labeled as such. I thought that was a big mistake at the time. It was a big mistake, and I have to say the FDA was lobbied very, very heavily by the biotechnology industry at the time. I was on the FDA Food Advisory Committee and got to watch that lobbying in action. And the industry's view was that if the foods were labeled, then people wouldn't buy them. And the FDA went along with that on the grounds that genetically modified foods were not materially different from foods developed through conventional genetic crosses. DNA is DNA no matter where it comes from, and was very resistant to the idea of labeling. I thought it was a mistake. And I thought it was a mistake because I thought the public would view it as trying to hide something. If genetically modified foods really are going to save the world's food supply and are really healthy and are really safe and are really all these other things that the industry claims, then they ought to be labeling it with great pride and ought to be insisting that it be labeled. But that's not how it worked out. And the only surprise that I have is that it took this long to get to this point. It's been 20 years. And I would have thought that there would have been pressure for labeling genetically modified foods much, much sooner than this. But there's now so much public interest in getting them labeled that the industry has gone to Congress to start talking to Congress about a voluntary labeling program that would allow industry to set the terms of what those labels would look like. My favorite part of that is that they want to be able to label genetically modified foods as natural.
And, getting back to sort of the labeling the government is contemplating now, like what is important? This system that we have in place, like you said, is from the early 90s. What is important? What information should be on these labels that we don't already have?
Well, the current food label came out of research in the late 1980s that dietary fat was a really significant problem, and since then obesity has become a really significant problem, and that's about calories in general. So the FDA has proposed emphasizing calories and de-emphasizing total fat, although leaving saturated fat on the label. It's also proposed something, a line for added sugars, which a lot of people are interested in because a lot of sugar is added to food, and most people don't recognize how much sugar is in food. The industry argues that added sugars are no different from naturally occurring sugars, and that's certainly true, but they know perfectly well how much sugar they've added, and I think it would be helpful to disclose it. And then there are some other things about changing the portion sizes. The portion sizes have always been extremely small relative to what people actually eat because they were based on studies in which people reported how much they were eating. And those studies were done generally in the 1960s and 70s. Portion sizes have increased greatly since then. And so the FDA wants to use more recent data to establish portion size standards for foods. It's that kind, a lot of it is extremely technical. And in fact, the proposal is hundreds of pages.
Let's move to the way in which we protect the safety of our food in this country. Give us a sense of where we're really falling down on the job.
Well, we're falling down on the safety issue because the FDA's rules for food safety have not been fully implemented, and the FDA has really not been given the resources that it needs to implement its new rules. We have a food safety system that's divided between two agencies, the Department of Agriculture, which does meat and poultry, and the FDA, which does pretty much everything else, although there's some overlap in some places. In the mid-1990s, the Department of Agriculture instituted what are called HACCP rules, which are a set of food safety rules for producing meat and dairy food safely. And those rules, once implemented, were responsible for reducing a lot of contamination problems in meat and poultry products. There still are problems with it, but not nearly as many as there used to be. And in a sense, those rules have been very successful. That is why when the Obama administration came in, it wanted similar rules for foods under FDA's jurisdiction. And when Congress passed the Food Safety Modernization Act in 2010, I think, those rules then went to the FDA for writing up the regulations, and those regulations have been issued one set at a time for the last several years, but they're not fully in place yet, and won't be fully in place for a couple of years. Once they are in place, then it's the FDA's job to enforce them, and these rules require food producers to follow very, very well-established rules for producing foods so that they're not contaminated with living organisms. So I think eventually it's going to work out okay, provided that the FDA gets the resources that it needs to implement these rules.
I think that's the thing that people don't understand. It's one thing to say the rules are on the books, and then of course you'll hear industry simply say, "Well, we just need to enforce the rules that are on the books." But meanwhile, their lobbying dollars are going to politicians who are basically starving these agencies of the resources they need to follow the rules in the books.
Yeah, and Congress has been starving this particular agency for 20 years now. And there's been report after report after report by scientific advisory committees talking about how dangerous it is for the country's food supply to have the FDA as weak as it is. I think a strong FDA is good for industry because it does two things. It establishes a level playing field so that every food producer has to follow the same rules, and the ones that mean well don't have to go out front on it and spend more and, you know, and lose their competitive edge. Everybody has to do it. The other reason is that it instills a great deal more trust of the public in the food supply and in the regulatory agency, and public trust is very important for both.
Hey, just explain that dynamic. I mean, in terms of the competitive edge that it gives those corporations to basically not follow good food safety practices, because that's sort
well,
of
nobody
the,
wants.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the opposite story that we hear from, let's say, a libertarian perspective, where it's, you know, that this is not for, you know, that a business that produces a food that is dangerous will go out of business, for instance.
Yeah, well, actually, that's not what happens. And we have so much evidence now of cost cutting around food safety issues. I mean, just one producer of one food after another after another. These things are in the newspapers all the time. Food companies are under enormous pressure to produce food as cheaply as possible so that they can keep their prices as low as possible so they can be competitive. And you have, if you have one company that really cares about these issues, takes them very seriously, institutes all of these food safety control plans, tests to make sure that the foods are not leaving their packing plants contaminated and so forth, they're spending more money than a company that's not doing that. And the punishment for companies that don't do it is minimal or non-existent. I mean, I can count on the fingers of one hand companies that have behaved very, very badly around food safety issues and have actually been punished for it in any way whatsoever. Yes, the cost of recall is very expensive, but from the company's calculations, apparently, the cost of recall is trivial in comparison to the cost of preventive controls. So the way the system has worked is that there is a great advantage to companies that are cutting corners, a financial advantage. And so that's what the FDA rules were designed to try to interfere with and to put everybody on a level playing field so that everybody had to play by the same rules. I think that's a good thing.
This may seem an obvious question, but why is it that consumers don't end up punishing a company that produces, well, we had to do a recall of a bunch of chickens, or we had to do a recall of this or that? I mean, why don't we see that from consumers?
Well, we don't see it because food safety risks are familiar. And, I mean, there's a whole literature on risk communication and risk perception. And that literature tells us that people are familiar with food safety problems. They don't think that they're not very scary. Unless you happen to be somebody who's really gotten hit badly by it. They're very common. Everybody has had diarrhea episode. Practically everybody has had some episode of diarrhea due to eating something that they shouldn't have. They were uncomfortable for a day or two, sometimes very uncomfortable. But they pass, and mostly they go away, and it's sort of one of those things. It's a risk that is easily accepted by the public, whereas genetically modified foods, which, the industry swears, and I have no evidence to the contrary, they've never hurt anybody physically. I mean, they have other problems, but they're not a direct source of human illness that anybody could trace, at least. Whereas food poisoning is easily traceable. Human illness is easily traceable to it. But people are much more afraid of genetically modified foods than they are of foods that are contaminated with bacteria.
Interesting.
That's human nature. Human nature.
Well, indeed. Well, Marion Nessel, author of Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. We will link to your book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
My pleasure.